Chair of the House Education Committee, Cheryl Youakim, 46B. Representative, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today. I know you're very busy today.
No, thank you for having me on that. And I just want to make sure we actually in the House have three different education committees. So I'm chair of the Education Policy Committee.
Well, and would this fall under were you consulted by the governor's office on this decision? Now let me start there.
Oh, actually, I have been in our committee has and our committee members have been in constant contact with the governor and Minnesota Department of Education since distance learning began. Mm-hmm. In fact, besides conversations I've had with students and parents and teachers and school social workers, school counselors, paraprofessionals, nutrition, school bus drivers, school board members, administrative staff all across the state starting in the beginning of April, we actually had three hearings in the Minnesota House Education Policy and Chair Dabney's Education Finance Committee. We combined to hear from all of those stakeholders as well to just see what they learned from distance learning, the opportunities and the challenges, what they thought summer school would look like, and then going into the fall. And I know MDE has had about 40 different working groups with all the same stakeholders as they've been moving towards guidance plans.
Governor Walz put forward the point very quickly. He said, yeah, this is the people who are just screaming, open the schools. That's a slogan. That's not a plan. The plan that's been put forward, there's a lot of thought that's gone into this. That's for sure. I'll start off with the formula here that's being used to kind of talk about the viability of education within any given school district or county, really, in this case, which is total number of cases for last 14 days divided by the county population divided by 10,000. It gives you a number, and that wherever your county falls into that number, it sounds like you could have in-person classes, a hybrid, or, you know, a hybrid distance learning option there. For the most part, it sounds like most schools would fall into the in-person, that, you know, obviously with precautions, most counties would fall within the in-person requirement, correct?
Actually, it all depends. It's only one side of the equation, but what I want to say, Matt, is I'm really glad that you brought up it being a slogan and not a plan. I think what people forget is schools never close.
Mm-hmm.
We had distance learning in the spring. We had a lot of teachers and staff and students and parents working very hard, making sure their kids were getting education. We've been open in the summer for summer school. And so when they say reopen, it's a little frustrating. Mm-hmm. I know how many people have been out there working really hard. And as the governor said on this press conference, that is just one data point they'll be looking at. What the local control data points would be the districts trying to decide how they can meet the MDH and CDC guidelines of social distance, masking, cleaning, what do their buildings, you know, air exchanges look like, the size of their classrooms. So there's a lot more than just that data set that's going into making this decision.
Well, and I also, and as you said, like you said, it's just a slogan to scream, open the schools. You have to have a plan. The thing I also like about this plan is that this does factor in the idea, and this shows you the complexity of this issue. The idea that has been put forward is, oh, that the rural schools, we should be able to open because we just don't have as many people. It's the big city schools that are going to have the problem. But when you look at it and look at the very intelligent people that have put the time, the money into this, it really does, you know, that's not it. There's no way you can paint with a wide brush here. There are some rural counties, especially in the southwestern part of the state, where the idea of, I think, in-person learning is a very bad idea right now. They're being pointing with that. I think that the concept of removing the one-size-fits-all narrative, that's, you know, there's a lot of people that were going to be concerned about this. This really takes that, any concern about that, out the window, because it really is based on what's going on in your local community.
Oh, exactly right. It really is about local folks teaming up and partnering with MDE and MDH with the guidance there. It's flexibility. It's being able to look at what is happening. Things you may start out with one plan and have to move to another depending on community spread. And that's why I think back in June, MDE came out with 100-page of guidance on getting the school district started on making plans for those three different approaches, those three different models, the in-person, the hybrid, and the distance. And, of course, kind of like preliminary engineering. They weren't able to fully, completely engineer all three of those plans, but they wanted them to start walking down this path because they knew there'd have to be, there may be times where you have to move to distance learning, let's say, during our regular cold and flu season in December and January, mm-hmm. when you already have a ton of students and teachers out, and then you also have COVID on top of that, might be a good idea just to go to distance learning for that month for everyone. Like, there's going to have to be that flexibility there.
I love as well the idea that you're factoring in the considerations for the, because I think one of the, and I'll say it, I'm saying this, the arguments I'm hearing from the right, the conservatives, is that, you know, sort of damn the torpedoes, get the teachers in there. But you have to look at this, especially from the teachers, from the staffing, from the, you know, people working in the cafeterias, the buses, the janitors. You know, just one point I've been talking about here. I mean, you look out in rural Minnesota. I've lived in rural Minnesota. Most of your substitute teachers are retired teachers, and they sure don't want to go into a potential dangerous situation. I like how this plan factors in, you know, very directly that we have to be looking out for the schools, the well-being of the school as an institution itself, because if we don't have the teachers and the staff and the support staff and the administration healthy and on board and at good staffing levels, there's, you know, this becomes a much larger problem.
Well, you make a very good point, Matt. There's a science about why kids need in-person learning, and there's a science behind how we do that safely. And I think this plan is a really good balance of looking at both of those. And you need to make sure that, you know, everyone deserves a safe working environment, mm-hmm. and a safe learning environment. And you have to look at both of those. It doesn't really have a help to have a school run when you're missing half your staff.
Cheryl Youakim is joining us, the House Education Policy Chair. Ah, there you go. And one of the things that's put out here, this is definitely going to come into your wheelhouse here. Governor Walz says another $250 million to go to face coverings for students, educators, and staff members, comprehensive COVID testing for educators and staff members, as well as other elements here. How much is this going to have to get approved by the legislature? And considering, I believe, the last special session is done, is this something we're going to have to wait for another special session to kick in if there is a need for the state legislature to act on this stuff?
That's a good question, Matt. Actually, with the way the COVID funds have been given to the states, there were some that were had to go through Title I formulas that they're already looking at with GEARS, but this $250 million is from the COVID fund that the executive council with the governor can distribute. That being said, they've still taken input from the schools and from the legislature on how that should be spent. $5 million of that is going to be focused on, like you said, getting those masks and face coverings and shields for teachers and students. The rest of that, they're going to have to look at, you know, it's going to be for staffing, nutrition, short on budgets. I've been pushing really hard when I talk to the administration of making sure that districts have a place to go to purchase the cleaning supplies they're going to need, because we've all been to Target or Walgreens and not being able to get 409 or Lysol spray or bleach wipes or hand sanitizer. So we don't want our schools and our teachers trying to find those on the open market. So trying to figure out ways they have some purchasing power, also making sure that, you know, just looking at one little aspect, the nutrition budgets. The nutrition budgets for our schools in the spring really had a tough time because they're very fee-based, and we didn't have kids in school buying meals. So they were already already struggling. Now you move into fall, and let's say you're doing a hybrid approach, or even if you're doing in-person for just your elementary, and with the distance that you're going to need to do for health and safety, you're going to have to probably be eating in the classroom or eating in a different way than you would in a large cafeteria. Mm-hmm. Well, that might mean cooking different. That might mean grab-and-go meals instead, which could be more expensive for their nutrition budget. So there is a lot of details that have to go into this, and I think that's why that balance needs to be there between local control and then also state support.
I also think it's very important that people have to keep this in mind, is that what happens on the first day of school, no matter where your school district is at, things could change, and they might change relatively quickly because, once again, we are dealing with this during a pandemic, and pandemics don't have a way. There's no way to predict what's going to happen here. I mean, you have to be prepared to be flexible, and I think that's the key, correct?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we have to be flexible. We have to anticipate that no matter where you're at when you start the school year, that, you know, things could change fairly quickly, and that we have to understand that we understand that it's not convenient, it's not easy, but the reality is trying to educate kids during a pandemic is a very monumental task, and we have to be more flexible than just hoping that whatever starts is the way we finish the school year.
No, you're exactly right, and I think that is also one of the reasons why you saw the guidance come out in June for people to start planning, but to have to wait until you're closer to when you have to make that final decision to what the numbers look like. The numbers that you're seeing now for that 14 days might look very different by September even as well. Mm-hmm. So you're right, Matt. Things will change as time moves on.
So for you specifically in the House, where is the next step here?
We'll be having a special session sometime around August 12th. Hopefully that'll be focused on finally getting a bonding bill, which we should have done during regular session. And then there may be some tweaks. I'm in the process of talking with our other education chairs and our school districts and folks to see if there's some little tweaks we need on legislation to make sure that everybody has the flexibility that they need. I've put a call in to find out if enough of the districts are able to change their start times if they have to, mm-hmm. or if they need legislation for that. What does it look like? What do we need to change for there being more access to substitute teachers in case we need that? Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate it. This is no easy thing. As you said very correctly, that this is school years never end. And as you ramp up for the beginning of this upcoming school year, the reality is that you've got so many still moving pieces that the fact that you're able to come up with a plan, it's basically a testament to you. It's a testament to Governor Walz and his team, the people in the House, all the politicians in the state that they're trying to work on this. I appreciate the time and I appreciate the effort you've put into this.
Well, and I think it really is a big testament to all the work our public schools are putting in and all the folks that work in them. Because it really is a really tough decision for our administrators and school board members and teachers on how they're going to implement this. And I know distance learning didn't work out the greatest for everyone in the fall, spring, yeah. But I know that they've learned a lot from that and are ready to move forward.
Cheryl Youakim, House Representative, House Policy Chair for the committee in the Minnesota House. I appreciate the time, Representative. Thank you very much. We are back tomorrow. Have a good one. Till tomorrow. See ya.